At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Need tips on finding work? Try the monthly jobs report. We'll talk to the 93-year-old billionaire whose Texas brand of stubborn led to modern fracking and forgiving debt, at least for a couple weeks. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, December 7th. Thanks for joining us. Let's start with what didn't happen today. Progress on the fiscal cliff. Nothing. Nada. So what did make headlines? Well, November's jobs report, which contained this news. The jobless rate fell to 7.7%, nearly a four-year low. 146,000 new jobs were created. We'll talk about what that all means to the whole economy. But first, if you don't have a job, can today's report be of any practical use to you? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
So I'm going to get my trusty HR manual off the shelf. Advice item number one, go to college.
Workers with a BA or more had an unemployment rate of 3.8%. Workers with less than a high school degree, 12.2%.
That's Heidi Schierholz at the Economic Policy Institute. She says healthcare, bars and restaurants, they've been hiring strongly, though many of the jobs pay low wages. Beth Herman of the HR firm Manpower says better-paying jobs are turning up where retiring workers need to be replaced.
Manufacturing is not leaving the United States. If anything, it's coming back. Transportation, utilities.
Also, she says, be ready to move, especially any place they're drilling or fracking for fossil fuels.
North and South Dakota, some of those states are screaming for talent right now.
Some sectors are still mortally wounded, like construction, but
as the housing market rebounds, lots of companies need moving and van storage drivers.
Michael Gritton runs Kentuckiana Works, the job agency in Louisville. So if his own niece corners him at the family Christmas party, what'll he tell her to go into?
Plastics.
No, for real?
One thing that niece should think hard about is information technology. There are jobs now and are going to be jobs in the future.
Starting with turning my HR binder into a mobile online app with location-based job search. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Joining us now to talk about today's jobs report for the Weekly Wrap are Heidi Moore of The Guardian and John Carney from CNBC. Hi, guys.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Well, we'll dive into the details of the report in a minute. First of all, what do you guys think of that advice in Mitchell's story? You know, need a job, go into IT, or move to North or South Dakota. I'm simplifying, but Heidi, what do you think?
I think it needs a sound effect, not a comment, and that sound effect would be a sad trombone. Wah, wah.
John?
Look, I mean, I do think that right here in New York, I see it all the time. People are desperately hiring anybody who can code an iPhone app, for instance.
Right.
You know, will have as many job offers as they can possibly stand. So it's good advice.
Let's get into the details of today's report. The jobless rate fell to 7.7% last month. Heidi, put that in perspective for us. Is that cause for celebration?
It's, well, not exactly. It is down from last month's 7.9%. But really, the reason it's lower is because there are fewer people in the workforce. The jobless rate measures who's in the workforce. It just means people are dropping out. And that's ultimately the problem. We still have 12 million people who are unemployed. And if we keep looking at those top line percentage numbers, we're not really acknowledging what they're going through.
Yeah. John, 146,000 jobs created, though, right?
Right. And we've been creating jobs for quite some time now. I think we're in the 33rd month since we started rebuilding jobs, and we're doing very well at it, not as well as we need to be doing. And it's going to take a long time before we get to anywhere like a normal employment rate. But, you know, it's a sign of a healthy economy that we're still, you know, that we are creating these jobs despite Hurricane Sandy, despite all the trouble that we see coming out of Washington. I think it is cause for celebration.
Yeah. John, were you surprised by that? Hurricane Sandy did not apparently hurt the jobless rate. How can that be? You guys live in New York. Does that ring true to you, John?
I wonder whether some of it is people not filing for unemployment because they're rebuilding their houses. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that filters forward. There may even be a sort of delayed effect because people had other things to worry about than getting unemployment insurance.
Yeah. Heidi, what about you? Does that ring true, the Sandy angle?
It doesn't at all. I mean, we saw in the ADP, the private payrolls report earlier this week, that Sandy was in effect. And also, even in this report, you can see things like people reporting that they're working part-time because of bad weather, or they didn't go to work because of bad weather.
Right.
And that can be code for Sandy. And we also saw construction jobs drop. And after a hurricane, you'd expect to see them increase. So there's something about the Sandy didn't matter issue that I think doesn't quite ring true.
Yeah. And we'll get revised numbers later on that could change that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, let's go to a corporate story real quick. There's a story out today that Delta Airlines got its hands slapped by the California Attorney General for not posting a privacy policy on its mobile app. And my very cynical question is, does anybody ever read these things anyway? Heidi, do you read them?
I don't read them, but I firmly believe that the tech industry needs to get its act together. If banks didn't disclose as much as tech companies don't disclose, they'd all be in court every day. Well, strike that. They are all in court every day already. But really, this is a consumer issue. And just because, you know, it's on some sort of tech device doesn't mean that they shouldn't tell consumers what their rights are. I think the court was right.
John, do you read them? And what do you think the importance is?
I never read them. I just check the little box. I think it's a very, very silly policy to have. But I think Heidi made a very, very good point here, which is the tech community does, in a lot of ways, believe it is above the law. They don't believe that rules about insider trading apply to them in a lot of cases. They don't believe that, you know, all of these rules about, you know, the privacy disclosures. They
right.
think, oh, well, you know, that's for those old line companies. It's not for us. I think they're going to have to grow up a little and realize that the rules that apply to everybody else still apply to them.
Right. Okay, we've got to end it there. Heidi Moore at The Guardian, John Carney at CNBC. Thanks a lot, guys, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
A mixed day on Wall Street. Details when we do the numbers. A large tanker called Obi River has just sailed eastwards from northern Europe to Japan. But here's the thing. It went through the Arctic Ocean, not the Suez Canal. It's the first time a ship like this has completed the voyage, and it shows just how dramatically the polar ice cap has melted. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports on how climate change is creating new business opportunities, especially for the Russians.
Obi River is not the first cargo ship to make the crossing, but it is the first big tanker to do so, carrying liquefied natural gas, perhaps the first of many. Gunnar Sander of the Norwegian Polar Institute says global warming is creating a viable new trade route through the Arctic Ocean.
The implication for shipping, first of all, is that you've had larger areas that are more or less ice-free, and you've had a longer season, which is navigable.
The Russian energy giant Gazprom chartered the tanker to carry the natural gas to Japan. Hal Brown is with the shipping journal Lloyd's List. He says sailing eastwards through the Arctic makes a lot more sense than using the traditional southern route via the Suez Canal.
It cuts sailing time between Russian ports and Asia from 40 days to about 22 days. So it saves owners a huge amount on fuel.
About $1 million per trip. Julian Lee of the Centre for Global Energy Studies says the OB River voyage is a vital commercial exercise by the Russians.
Gazprom is trying to prove that this northern sea route is a viable way for it to deliver gas to markets in Asia.
There is a great deal at stake for the Russians. They had been hoping to sell billions of cubic metres of LNG to the US, but with America's shale gas revolution, that market has vanished. Russia must sell its LNG to China and Japan instead. Global warming will help. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
As we do on the occasional Friday, we bring you the stuff that didn't quite make the headlines this week. Our friends at the Dinner Party Radio Show, Rico Galliano and Brendan Francis Noonan, asked some of our colleagues what news they'll be talking about this weekend.
Stacey Vanek Smith, senior reporter, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, H&M, you know, the fast fashion company, they just announced this week that they're going to start accepting used clothes. You can bring your used clothes into any H&M in the world.
Wait, are they going to launch an H&M vintage business?
No. They're teaming up with a nonprofit. They're going to, like, reuse and recycle clothes. They say clothes end up in landfills, and 95% of them can be reused in some way.
All right, but if I see Romney Ryan t-shirts at H&M next year...
Yeah, maybe time to start asking some questions.
Ethan Lindsay, acting managing editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Australian scientists have developed a pineapple that tastes like coconut.
Okay, that seems ridiculous.
I think they were trying to make pineapples juicier and sweeter, and it just so happened that they made it taste like coconut. My question is how are they going to now genetically engineer it to ferment the alcohol and create a piña colada pineapple, rum included?
It could be science fact. If you could also get it to genetically sprout like a teriyaki chicken burger, I think you'd have basically grown a Margaritaville restaurant.
Chris Brube, intern, what's your story?
Well, a study came out this week that shows that beer actually has antiviral properties.
The chicken soup people can't be happy about this.
I'm sure they're not. It turns out that beer has this chemical in it called humulone that comes from hops, and that gives beer its taste, but it also helps fight the virus that causes pneumonia.
This is amazing.
I mean, I'm a little bit suspicious about the study because it was done, and I am not making this up, it was done at a place called the Sapporo Medical University.
That's like the Japanese campus of the Budweiser Institute.
Brendan and Rico's show is called The Dinner Party. There's a link on our homepage. Coming up, love it or hate it, looks like fracking's here to stay, thanks to a Texan named George Mitchell.
And George said, okay, let me get this right. We plug the well without evaluating it? What were you thinking? What were you smoking? You know, and it wasn't quite that nice.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 81.6% to close at 13,155. The Nasdaq deleted 11.4% to end the day at 2978. The S&P 500 gained 4.3% to finish at 1418. For the week, the Dow rose 1%, the Nasdaq fell 1.1%, and the S&P 500 gained 0.1%. Apple peeled off 2.5% today and lost nearly 9% for the week. Overseas, France's CAC 40 and Britain's FTSE stepped up less than 0.25%. Germany's DAX trudged down 0.25%. Japan's Nikkei shaved off 0.2%. And bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.63%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Placing a call from Santa Claus at the North Pole to FedEx. Get ready for the busiest day ever. The shipper expects to move 19 million packages. Why? E-commerce is affecting volume. Yeah, those of you shopping from home in your bathrobe. And the Nobel Peace Prize award ceremony takes place in Oslo. This year's award goes to the European Union. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. If your company matches your retirement savings, that payment typically shows up on your pay stub a couple times a month. Well, this week, IBM notified employees it's changing its 401k match. It's going to make one lump sum payment per year. So what's the difference? Well, turns out a lot of money, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Nancy Hua with the Pension Rights Center has been keeping lists of companies that have frozen their pension plans or cut their 401k match. When she heard about IBM's latest move,
my first thought was, am I going to have to start another list? Because, you know, it just seems like it's another step in this trend of employers moving away from helping their employees save for retirement.
Here's one way employees stand to lose. If they leave the company before December 15th, they won't get that year's contribution unless they retire. That could amount to several thousand dollars. Allison Borland is a benefits consultant with Aon Hewitt. She says, like so many businesses in a lagging economy, IBM is under pressure to cut costs.
This is a way to do it without significantly impacting those employees who stick with the company for the full year.
But even those workers could still take a hit. The match money won't be working for them throughout the year. It'll be working for IBM.
So any gains in the marketplace from this investment money will not be anything in my benefit.
Earl Mungen works at an IBM plant in Burlington, Vermont. He says the 401k change is another blow to workers. 4 years ago, IBM froze its traditional pension benefits. Aon Hewitt's Allison Borland says only about 9% of employers pay their 401k matches at the end of the year. But she says more may follow IBM's lead to save money. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So IBM's 401k move may sound rather Scrooge-like this time of year, but here's an anti-Scrooge business story for you. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac announced this week that from mid-December until after the new year, they will not evict residents of homes in foreclosure. Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff asks, is this altruism or a publicity stunt?
The eviction halt could be both. Yolanda Crockett of Fannie Mae says the government-sponsored mortgage giant wants to do the right thing.
We want to give families who've gone through a hard time some relief at the holidays.
Fannie Mae's moratorium runs from December 19th to January 2nd. The foreclosure crisis is one reason Fannie Mae made this a nationwide policy 5 years ago. Big banks are also getting into the holiday spirit. Bank of America, Citigroup, and U.S. Bank are among those taking a break from evictions. Wells Fargo has had this policy for decades, says spokesperson Vicki Adams.
It's a very traditional step for us to take. It's not unusual.
So is this out of the goodness of their hearts or something else? Depends on who you ask. In the goodness camp, Pamela Banks of Consumers Union.
I think they should be applauded. This is a very humane, charitable thing to do.
Then there's Ira Reingold, who heads the National Association of Consumer Advocates.
Wow, that's so great of them. I'm completely unimpressed.
His theory about the moratoria?
They simply don't want to be on the local news at night, putting a family out around the holidays.
Mortgage lenders aren't the only ones who don't want to look like Scrooge. First Energy, an electric utility with 6 million customers, says it won't turn off the lights for non-payment during the last week of December. Mark Durbin is a spokesman.
It's just our way of doing something a little special during the holidays.
If you're looking for a Grinch, try the Repo Man. The ones we called said they've been known to take property even on a holiday. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
So take a listen to all of this. A Blue Ribbon report suggests the U.S. may outproduce the Saudis before long. Next week, the feds update us on fracking and water safety. And the anti-fracking movie Promised Land comes out this Christmas, starring Matt Damon. Hard to keep up, isn't it? Well, today, let's step back and look at how all the fuss over fracking began. As part of our Petrostate series, reporter Scott Tong of our sustainability desk got a rare interview with the father of fracking.
He cracked the code. That's what they say in the oil patch about George Mitchell. See, in the 1970s and 80s, the big pools of natural gas were tapped out. The drillers looked in new places, but they were stumped.
Open Sarsaparilla?
Like that old cartoon.
Open Saskatchewan? Open Septuagenarian?
Till Mitchell Energy gave it a try, in a formation called the Barnett Shale.
The Barnett was a very big reservoir. If we could make it work, it could be very profitable.
Now 93, George Mitchell spoke from a hotel he owns in Galveston, Texas. Mitchell is the son of a Greek immigrant, a billionaire, and by all accounts, he's a stubborn soul. His breakthrough was coaxing natural gas out of stubborn rock called shale, unlocking a new door to fossil energy. Diana Hinton is a historian at the University of Texas Midland.
George Mitchell's significance is both national and global. What his work did opened up possibilities that are mind-boggling.
When Mitchell first poked into shale in the early 80s, it was the longest of shots. The energy is trapped in dense rock. Some drillers figured you had to explode an atom bomb down below to get the energy out. Most sniffed and walked away.
I've had a lot of my engineers and geologists say, "You waste your money, Mitchell. We knew enough to go on and keep doing it."
Now, "we" did not always include his staff. Geologist Dan Stewart worked for Mitchell then. He recalls shutting down an unpromising well.
And George said, "Okay, let me get this right. We plugged the well without evaluating it. What were you thinking? What were you smoking?" You know, and it wasn't quite that nice.
In 1982, Mitchell announced a deadline. "Produce shale gas for me in 10 years, or the company's in trouble."
He says, If you team, don't think you're up to this challenge, let me know. I'll find people who are."
How'd you react?
I had a wife and four kids. I said, "We can do it, boss."
Actually, many innovation experts say time pressures tend not to spur creative genius. It spurs cussing.
And when you had an up, you thought, "We've got it now." But then, 2 weeks from then, you'd have this down. And you'd say, "What the hell?"
Stewart's team learned they had to break the rock to get the gas out, like cracking a windshield with a bat. In this case, the bat is fluid shot down the hole to fracture or frack the shale rock. Now, fracking was not new. It's been around since the 1940s. But this was a tweak. Mitchell Energy tried all kinds of chemicals, gels, and frack juice recipes. One helpful engineer suggested a horse manure frack.
That's pretty good quit. We were discouraged that we weren't getting good results. And we had tried all other types of fracks.
By the mid-90s, Mitchell Energy's money was tight. So one worker posed a budget frack with mostly water. Water tends to swell rock, shrinking the fractures. But heck, they tried it. Mitchell Energy alum Kent Bowker.
"Conventional wisdom was wrong. We want low viscosity fluid, just water." And that was an eye-opener.
Turned out, the water got more gas. Luck, like in many innovations, played a starring role. So did Kent Bowker. He had a hunch the Barnett held more gas than assumed. He just needed money to test it. "Nope," said company president Bill Stevens.
"He physically stuck his hand in my face and said, 'Stop right there. We have enough of that stuff.'" Bill Stevens never believed in it.
But George Mitchell blessed the project, which turned up four times more gas. It's like fishing in a sea with four times the fish.
And Mr. Mitchell got this big smile on his face. He leans forward and he looks at all of us. "This is huge. This is the biggest thing that's ever happened to this company. It's also the biggest secret. No one can talk about this."
Yeah, I remember the meeting. Of course, I didn't want him to tell anybody. Just
Mitchell Energy found the keys to money-making shale wells. They cracked the code.
Open saddle soap. Open sesame.
Now, it did take 17 years.
That's true with almost every major commercially viable innovation that I can think of.
Harvard business professor Teresa Amabile. She says the lesson here is keep persisting and keep failing. Yeah, failing.
There are many, many more failures than there are successes in most innovation journeys. What you need to do is figure out how to extract failure value figure out what you can learn from what went wrong.
Now, shale fracking is widespread and it keeps evolving. There's fracking paired with horizontal drilling, fracking for oil. Now, a breakthrough is one thing. Whether it's good for society is another. And like nuclear energy and genetic engineering, shale fracking has critics, like Emily Wirth at Food and Water Watch.
That's going to prolong our dependence on the fossil fuel industry, which is in their best interest at a time when we need to be aggressively moving away from using fossil fuels.
And there's the question of polluting drinking water. Mitchell's view is a bit of a twist. He supports fossil fuel taxes, which could phase out his discovery. In fact, Mitchell gives millions to research clean energy. And Mitchell wants stiff oversight of drillers, especially the independent little guys.
They're wild people. You just can't control them. And if it doesn't do it right, penalize the oil and gas people.
A Texas oil man talking out of school. George Mitchell has spent a life turning assumptions inside out. And now his shale breakthrough has turned America's fossil fuel conversation on its head, from one of scarcity to one of abundance. In Galveston, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Scott can explain how fracking works in only 60 seconds. Really? Check out the animated video on marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein has a Tony apartment in Manhattan and a mansion on Long Island, but he's not stopping there. Apparently, he's just bought another house on Long Island, a Bridgehampton estate listed at $32.5 million. 8,000 square feet, 7 bedrooms, 6 bathrooms, wet bar, tennis court, gardens, pool, but no ocean view. $32.5 million and no ocean view, apparently, they say. Mr. Blankfein's just not an ocean kind of guy. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average added 81 points, 0.6% to close at 13,155. The NASDAQ deleted 11 points, 0.4% to end the day at 2978. The S&P 500 gained 4 points, 0.3% to finish at 1418. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, buying presents for loved ones is hard enough, but gifting a perfect stranger...
Secret Santa is sort of, in one sense, a recipe for disaster, because by construction, you're buying for somebody you probably don't know. On the other hand, it's very, very good compared to having to buy for everyone at the party.
Economically efficient holiday shopping tips on Marketplace Money. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. I'm Sarah Gardner. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.